preparing for a last-ditch assault. Before I could strike out, however, the fat spiderkin hovering above me reared back, issuing a horrendous shriek of angry disapproval. I glanced at my warhammer, trying to figure out what I'd just done and how. But then Cutter's face flashed in front of mine.
"Hang in there, Grimjack,"
he said, prying his hands into my armpits and dragging me away from the howling spider and into the relative safety of the trees. He lifted my bulk with a grunt and gracelessly tossed me over his shoulder like a sack of potatoes, so my torso dangled down his back.
"I think we've overstayed our welcome,"
he yelled as he broke into a lurching run. The ride was far from pleasant. Each step sent a lancing pain up through my stomach and into my punctured lung. Another round of terrible spidery yowls brought my head up. We were being pursued. A small pack of the creatures scuttling through the foliage, leaping from tree to tree, closing the distance in a hurry. My health was still dropping by the second, but I hesitated to down one of the health regen potions at my belt. Quick as Cutter was moving, those things would overtake us in no time. Unless I could find a way to slow them down.
"Faster, Cutter!"
I hollered as I flopped up and down, gritting my teeth as his shoulder dug into my gut. My health bar began flashing an angry, infected red as it dropped to 15%. But a sweet flood of arctic cold filled my limbs in an instant. With my life hanging in the balance, I had access to my otherwise restricted Umbra Bolt ability. I lifted my right hand, envisioning a burning ball of shadow forming in my palm. Something inside me moved, shifted, and suddenly the cold congregated to my outstretched limb, seeping from my skin, wreathing my hand in flickering shadow. I grinned and willed the Umbra Bolt out. Light erupted, streaking away, slamming into one of the pursuing arachnoids. The creature exploded in a ball of violet shadow, hissing and stumbling, both hurt and temporarily blinded. I pumped fistful after fistful of shadow power at the spiderkin, keeping one eye on my health bar as I worked. This was a fine balance. I could only access the Umbra power with my health below 15%, but I didn't want to die either. I clipped one of the creatures in mid-leap, swatting it from the air and amputating the majority of its legs in the process. Another went down for good as I scored a critical hit in its horrifying face, turning its eye-studded head into a disgusting spray of green mist. At 75 spirit per shot, the barrage of Umbra Bolts quickly ate through my spirit supply. But thankfully, a purple potion at my belt restored me to 50%, giving me another 4 or 5 blasts. My health was still plummeting, but I didn't want to waste my limited opportunity to use Umbra Bolt. I sent out a few sporadic shots, kicking up dirt and felling a palm tree, hoping to slow our pursuers down. One particularly well-placed shot, by which I mean lucky, knocked a scurrying spiderkin from the side of a tree. The creature fell directly into the path of several other arachnoids, tripping up one while being trampled by the other. With my spirit once more low and my health hovering at around 5%, I finally pulled a health potion from one of my belt slots and downed the thing in a single gulp. The taste of cherry-flavored medicine burning across my tongue and down my throat. About as pleasant as real-world medicine, but it worked much, much faster. My health bar almost immediately jumped to 25%, saving my skin, but robbing me of my death-dealing Umbra Bolt spell, which was problematic, especially since even more spiders were scuttling out of the woodwork, joining the hunt. And they were close now, 10 or 15 feet away.
"Faster, Cutter! Faster! I'm moving as quick as I can go, Freddy! You weigh a lot more than you look,
he shouted, huffing and puffing. We rounded a bend, slipping between several trees, and then we were temporarily airborne as Cutter leapt over a meandering stream 3 or 4 feet wide, landing on a narrow dirt trail on the other side. We didn't come down easy. The pain redoubled in my middle, and worse, the rough landing also cost us precious seconds. When I glanced back up, though, I could only stare in slack-jawed amazement. The spiders had stopped. Just stopped. They were lined up along the edge of the stream, staring at us with malicious, greedy eyes. But they made no move to cross the slow-moving water. Why in the world would these things stop? They couldn't be scared of a shallow stream, could they? That's when I caught sight of the totem. A crudely carved log jutted from the ground near the path. The wooden post was covered in harsh, angular script and topped by the yellowing skull of a spider, decorated in swirls of red paint. We must have entered some kind of safe zone, though a small part of me wondered what a horde of spiderkin had to fear. That thought fled, however, as the ground gave out below Cutter and me, and we plummeted into a gaping hole, the bottom lined with jagged wooden spikes. We'd carelessly run into a trap. I flipped forward, head over tail, screaming as I braced for the impact to come. As I prepared to be impaled through the chest, stomach, neck, or face. That was a bad way to go. But still probably better than being cocooned alive as a late-night snack for a bunch of hungry spider babies. I smashed hard into the ground, landing on one shoulder. An assortment of dirt, twigs, leaves, and gravel chewed at my skin like sandpaper as I flipped and rolled. I finally came to a jerky stop on my back, hurt but surprisingly free of spikes. I pushed myself up onto my elbows and stole a look around. I'd landed on the edge of the pit, one of the only areas devoid of the angled wooden spears sticking up from the ground like rusty nails. Cutter hadn't fared so well. He lay just a few feet to my right, whimpering softly as he stared at a bloody spike piercing one thigh clean through. He slipped trembling fingers into a pouch at his belt and pulled free a health vial, uncorking it with his teeth, then taking a long gulp.
"Bollocks!"
he grunted at me through gritted teeth, his brow coated with sweat, his face stained with dirt.
"This Wazok ass badger right here," he slapped at the gore-tipped spear in his leg, "is preventing me from recovering. It's gonna keep on sapping my health until I can get it out."
I pushed myself upright with a groan, downed another health potion myself, I wouldn't do Cutter any good dead, then wobbled over, took a knee, and began examining the wound with gentle fingers. The shaft was really lodged in there, and I couldn't see an easy way to get him free, which was probably the whole point of the trap. Someone falls in and slowly bleeds to death no matter how many health potions they have in their inventory. There was only one thing I could do. I needed to break the shaft. "This might hurt a little," I warned as I stood and spread my feet, hammer raised. Cutter grimaced and nodded.
"Do it."
He flinched as I laid into the crude spear. My hammer thudded into the wood a few inches above his leg, and he cried out in protest. All that vibration couldn't feel good, but this was the only way. Again and again I smashed at the wood, chips and chunks flying away as Cutter screamed. After a few minutes, the spike finally broke in two, which allowed me to wiggle his leg out, revealing a ragged hole the size of my fist running clean through his upper leg. It was bad and graphic. But I'd seen worse IRL, though not often. With that done, I dragged him over to the side of the pit, away from the death spikes, wadded up an extra shirt from my pack, and applied pressure to the wound on instinct. Not sure if it made any difference, probably not. But between that and a few more health potions, Cutter was more or less back to normal in a few minutes. By that time, both of my spider-induced debuffs had also faded, meaning we were in the clear, health-wise. The only problem was, we were now stuck in a hole 25 feet deep without a foreseeable way up, while the already gloomy forest was moving toward genuine night. Far from an ideal situation. I scooted back and flopped down, leaning against the sheer earthen wall behind me, sudden exhaustion starting to set in. I wasn't quite sure how the tired debuff worked in VGO. Was it related simply to the sleep versus wake ratio, or were there other factors to consider, such as physical effort and injuries? I didn't have an answer, but I was tired, and also hungry. I opened up my pack, removed the campfire kit I'd picked up at Trajan's, and coaxed a little flame to life using some kindling and the split spear end I'd smashed to pieces. Cutter watched me in silence. Next, I dug into my pack and removed some of the food I'd picked up for this expedition. Bread, cheese, mutton. The food appeared in my hands, the bread a little too hard, the mutton cold, but a few minutes over the fire warmed the meat right up. I distributed the meat once it was done, dripping hot grease to the ground.
"Don't suppose I ever told you how much I ate spiders, did I?"
Cutter said around a mouthful of mutton, eyes watching the fire as the night grew damp and a smidge chilly. I shook my head and tore off a chunk of pungent cheese.
"Well, then let me go on the record and say it. I royally hate spiders. Miserable bastards, the whole lot of them. They always turn up in the worst situations, too. One time, several years back this was, I'd fallen into a bit of a tough financial bind, so I agreed to clear a dungeon as part of a merc team, picking up a little extra coin on the side to repay some outstanding debts I owed to an unfriendly fellow with a penchant for leg breaking. At any rate,"
he waved a hand through the air, the gesture saying the backstory wasn't important,
"while scouting out traps, I stumbled into a room filled with the leggy buggers. Not quite so aggressive or large as these, but very unfriendly. They swarmed me in a blink and had me strung up before I knew what hit me. My team rescued me before the creepy crawlies could turn me into a meal, but I haven't been able to stomach the sight of them since."
He shivered at the memory.
"Speaking of,"
I said, suppressing a yawn with one hand, "thanks for coming back for me. With the spiders, I mean. I know I can respawn, but I sure wasn't looking forward to being lunch for the queen." His face grew dark.
"I'm not what anyone might call a moral man, but I couldn't leave you to that fate, even if you'd eventually recover."
He shook his head.
"And so you know, she wasn't going to eat you, Grimjack. She was going to string you up, cut you open, then load you full of eggs. You'd live in total agony for a week or two, right up until those eggs hatched and the baby spiderkin ate their way out of your body, nasty as they come."
He arched an eyebrow.
"I suppose she might have ate what was left of you, though."
I sat in quiet horror for a spell. Again, under normal circumstances, this game was a lawsuit waiting to happen. "Wow, that's total nightmare fuel," I said, leaning my head against the dirt wall. I closed my eyes for a moment, a giant yawn escaping my mouth. Then, despite the day's experience and the fact that I was dirty and in a pit, I somehow dozed off. 27. Captives. Someone urgently shook my shoulder, roughly jerking me back and forth.
"Wake up, Jack!"
A vaguely familiar voice whispered at me. I shrugged and tried to turn away. A bright flare of pain exploded in my cheek as an open-handed slap smashed into my face, knocking my head to one side. Begrudgingly, I cracked open my eyes. Cutter loomed over me, gaze swapping back and forth between me and something up on the edge of the pit.
"Wake up, you moron!"
he fervently hissed again, jostling my shoulder. The fire had burned down to red embers, blanketed by a coat of gray ash, and the sky was still dark above. At most, a couple of hours had passed. It took my eyes a handful of seconds to adjust to the dim light, but when they did, I easily spotted the quartet of strange specters regarding us from the top of the pit. Lean, humanoid figures. Two men, two women, with chalky white skin, decked out in crudely stitched armor, soft boots, and braces lined with gleaming razors. The gear was studded with chunks of bone, ferocious teeth, and feathers in a myriad of colors, giving our onlookers a feral and dangerous appearance. I could tell they were watching us, but it was impossible to guess their thoughts or intentions, since their faces were covered by horrifying masks, crafted from animal skulls decorated in a similar manner to the spider head I'd seen affixed to the totem marker by the river.
"These blokes don't look particularly friendly,"
Cutter said, glancing over his shoulder.
"But if I had to bet, I'd say this is the lot we're here to find."
He stood slowly, raising his hands skyward, showing he held no weapons.
"Hello there, friends,"
he said with a wave toward the figures.
"Not sure if you understand me or not, but I'm hoping you do. Me and my friend here have come in search of Chief Cole of the Arcani clan. Don't suppose you fine folks will be willing to give us a hand out of this pit, then point us in the right direction, eh?"
The masked figures regarded us for a long minute, then disappeared, retreating from view.
"Good work, Cutter,"
I said, pushing myself upright, then brushing the flaky earth from the seat of my pants with one hand. "You scared them off."
"As long as they don't murder us,"
he replied, voice drawn and worried,
"I'll consider that a win. Unfortunately, I don't think we're going to get that lucky."
He finished as the masked faces appeared once more.
"Chief Cole,"
one of them said, his voice deep and gruff.
"Where did you hear this name? Who told you to come to the lands of the Arcani and speak true, outsiders? If you lie, we will find out and you will suffer. Lie, and we will personally ferry you back across the stream and into the many arms of the Meng Mong, the Spider Queen and her brood."
For a long, stupid moment, I looked to Cutter, expecting him to take the lead and answer. Instead, he stole a glance at me and planted a sharp elbow into my ribs.
"You're wrong, Grimjack. These are your people, your quest, after all."
I gulped, then reached a hand into my tunic, pulling the leather thong the dying Merc-Elf had entrusted into my care, the mark of the Matal, embossed with a raven.
"My friend and I hooked a thumb toward Cutter, "were taken captive by a black priest of Serthrog," I began. Then, as quickly as I could manage, I spooled out the tale, recounting our escape and my subsequent encounter with the dying Merc-Elf. "So," I concluded, "she gave me this talisman as a sign of my trustworthiness, and charged me with bringing word of her death to the chief of the Arcani." They were silent for a moment.
"I don't like it,"
a woman said, giving a shake of her head, the great horns of her mask swishing and swaying.
They are outsiders, Baymore, and he,
she nodded toward me,
is of the Lost Tribe. Everyone knows the Lost Ones cannot be trusted. How do we know they are not merely Viridian sympathizers? Sympathizers looking to curry favor by mapping our lands or assassinating Cole. The human has a certain sneaky look to him. Is it so hard to believe he could be Sicari?
And what of the talisman?
The man asked in return, more statement than question.
Does that not merit some small measure of trust?
No,
she replied flatly.
It is unwise. What if they captured this missing Matal, tortured her to learn the name of our chief, then stole the talisman? It is not beyond belief, Baymore. The Viridian's shame and indecency know no bounds. Caution is better here, I think. Smarter. Let us kill them and wash our hands of this.
Amara makes a good argument, said a different masked man. These are evil days after all. We'll give them quick, clean deaths, then hang their bones by the path as a deterrent against other interlopers. This is good, I think.
Well, boy, this is about to turn ugly,
Cutter whispered sharply in my ear.
Do something. Anything. This is your show, Jack. You're the Merc Elf.
The four on the ridge spread out, and suddenly each held a short curved bow, carefully knocking arrow to string. Oh no. They were going to execute us on the spot.
Wait!
I shouted as a bout of inspiration struck.
The woman, the Matal, who gave me the talisman. She gave me something else too.
I whipped open my inventory and hurriedly removed my leather bracers. Then, hastily rolled up my left sleeve. I held my forearm up like a shield, the black handprint standing out in sharp relief against my gunmetal gray skin.
She marked me with this.
For a long beat, nothing happened. Which was both good and bad considering the circumstances. But eventually, one by one, they lowered their raised bows.
He has the mark,
the man, Baymore, said.
Is there some explanation for this, Amara?
He asked, tone slightly accusatory.
No,
the woman replied with a sigh.
No Matal would offer the mark unless the shadow spark is present.
She paused, slung her bow, then crossed her arms as she regarded us.
I suppose the truth of his story is for Cole to decide. We could still kill the human, though,
she offered with a shrug.
He has neither the talisman nor the mark, truly an outsider. What say you, lost one?
She shouted down to me.
Will you allow us to kill this traveling companion of yours to spare your life?
Cutter stole an uneasy look at me, a nervous grin stretching across his face.
Don't hang me out to dry here, Jack. We're in this together, eh?
I smiled, shook my head, and slid right, repositioning myself in front of Cutter, using my body as a shield.
No,
I replied to the Merc Elf woman above.
Either you offer us both safe passage, or you kill us both.
I drew my warhammer from the frog at my belt.
But, word to the wise, we're not going to go easy.
That wasn't true. If they decided to kill us, we'd fold like a bad hand. But maybe they wouldn't know that. The four Akhani suddenly broke into a chorus of chuckles and hoots.
Good answer,
Amara replied.
Perhaps you will have what it takes to be Matal after all. We will take you and your friend to see Cole, but be warned. If there is deceit in your heart, Cole will know, and what he will do to you will be far worse than death by spider.
With the threat made, the four Akhani quickly lowered down a pair of ropes and hauled Cutter and me out of the pit. It wasn't all hugs and high fives after that, though. No. In short order, they bound our hands behind our backs with chafing strips of rope, then fitted us both with metal collars affixed to chains so they could drag us along. The collars, aside from being positively frigid, offered a string of terrible penalties. Debuffs added. Bound. Movement rate reduced by 10%. Duration, indefinitely. Drained. Health, stamina, and spirit regeneration reduced by 30%. Duration, indefinitely. Inhibited. Carry capacity, minus 40 pounds. Stealth is 50% more difficult. All spells have a 50% increased chance to fail. Duration, indefinitely. Assuming Cutter and I lived through this, I'd need to get my hands on a few of these collars. They'd sure come in handy against the enemies I'd made for myself over the past couple days.
"If you failed to keep up," the woman said, rounding on me, "I will sling you over my shoulder and carry you all the way to Yunam like a mewling child. And you,"
she gave the chain attached to Cutter's collar a stiff yank,
"will keep up, or I will slit your throat and leave your remains for the crocodiles. Now, move."
XXVIII. Chief Cole. It took 2 or 3 hours of hard walking to get to the Merkelf city, Yunam. At first, the path was easy to follow. But the further into the forest we went, the more often the trail veered into thick tangles of swampy vegetation, or hooked through shallow bogs, which made moving nearly impossible. Our guides, though, walked the route with the confidence of people who'd made the same trek 1,000 times before. They seemed to know every pitfall, every stone, and their steps always found the stable rock in the mud, or the dry patch of grass in the otherwise mushy marshlands. Not that they shared any of that information with us. They were an abnormally tight-lipped group, and our time passed in silence, with the exception of the occasional muttered curse from Cutter. Eventually, we started to see subtle signs of habitation. At first, it was guard towers, built into the branches of spreading trees. The towers were nearly invisible, heavily camouflaged with mud, sticks, leaves, and vines. But my keen sight ability quickly outlined the blurred edges of the structures. Then, after a time, I noticed the jungle had been cleared back in places to make room for the increasingly broad dirt path, which almost resembled a crude road. After even more walking, the dirt path finally morphed into a cobblestone street made from dark, worn river rock. The stone walkway carved through the trees, twisting and winding this way and that, following the natural contours of the land. We rounded a corner, identical to 1,000 others before it, and, suddenly, found ourselves at a wooden palisade with a rough gate already open, waiting to receive us. The town beyond the gate was a far cry from what I'd experienced in Rowanheath. While the Woad City vaguely resembled a mix between medieval Europe and the ancient Roman Empire, this place didn't look like any city I'd ever seen, in real life or on the big screen. The town was built among twisted moss-covered trees, the urban sprawl taking great care to give the towering plants room to grow. The buildings were built from an amalgamation of wood, mud, and palm fronds, all joined together with odd bits of leather, tangles of luminescent green moss, and gobs of silvery spider silk. Not a lot of curb appeal, no cozy little townhomes I could see myself settling down in, and also no actual curbs to speak of. All of the buildings towered high above the ground, raised up on dark wooden struts, giving the homes a strangely arachnoid appearance.
Considering we were in a swamp that probably received a fair amount of rainfall, this area was likely called the Storm Marshes for a good reason, I guessed the elevation was for flooding. It was still weird, though. Our guards pulled us through the center of town, the residents staring at us with hard, guarded gazes. I saw more than one Merc-Elf parent usher kids up rickety stairs and into homes at our passing. So far, I didn't know much about the Akhani clan, but one thing was readily apparent. Outsiders were really, really, really not liked, which didn't bode well for us. Yunam was also radically smaller than Rowanheath, so it took only a handful of minutes before our escorts dragged us to a halt at our final destination, a massive and twisted tree. The thing was fat and gnarled, with giant boughs branching off from the trunk, reaching for the sky like 100 broken fingers. Great ropes of moss clung to every branch, to every twig, pulsing with a soft light. A set of weathered stone steps climbed up into the tree's face, dead-ending at a squat door inset directly into the trunk, flanked by a pair of circular windows shedding weak yellow firelight. One of the guards, a man who hadn't spoken more than a dozen words, loosened my hand restraints, removed the metal collar from my neck, then gave me a little shove toward the stairs. "I thought you said we were probably assassins," I commented, rubbing at the raw skin around my wrists. "Aren't you worried I might try to do something?"
"We said he might be Sicari,"
the still-masked Amara replied, with a nod to Cutter.
"You? No, I don't think so. Besides, we are at times overprotective of our chieftain. He is a great warrior and a powerful necromancer of the Matal. Try anything, and he'll rip the soul from your body. Now."
She paused, staring at me through the mask slits.
"Up you go."
"What about my friend?" I asked.
"He does not bear the talisman,"
she replied, deadpan.
"Nor does he have the mark. So."
She paused, and it almost sounded like she was smiling.
"He will remain in our custody until Chief Cole determines your intent. If he declares your innocence, you and your friend live. And if he finds you guilty?"
She shrugged, unconcerned by the prospect.
"Our pigs are always hungry."
"Don't screw this up!"
Cutter called as the guards dragged him away, deeper into the village. Amara, however, accompanied me to the top of the stairs, then pounded on the door with a closed fist. Thunk, thunk, thunk.
"Enter!"
boomed a deep, masculine voice that sounded like a cement mixer loaded down with bricks. Amara opened the door and rudely shoved me through before slipping in herself. Despite the foreboding exterior, the tree's interior was beautiful, well-lit, and clean. There wasn't much by way of furniture, but what I saw was all finely made and polished to a dull glow. Elegantly curved bookshelves lined the walls and were heavy laden with thick leather-bound tomes and a host of arcane potions and ingredients. Chief Cole lounged in a pile of colorful pillows at the far side of the room, thumbing through a dusty book laid out on a squat rectangular table in front of him. After seeing the elaborate and terrifying attire of the Akhani Rangers, I'd come expecting a nightmare shaman looming on a throne made of human bones. But the chief was none of those things. He was large and heavily muscled, with black hair heavily streaked with gray, and wore plain clothing that would have let him pass unnoticed in Rowanheath. His bushy eyebrows nearly climbed into his hairline as his gaze flicked between me and my guard.
"I see your patrol has yielded some interesting results," he said,
closing his book and rubbing absently at his chin. Amara bowed formally, removing her mask in the process. She had the same gray skin as the rest of the Merc Elves, short black hair shaved down to the skin on one side, and a few swirling tattoos covering one cheek. She was younger than I'd expected, late 20s, early 30s, but just a glance at her violet eyes told me her years had been hard and painful, filled with violence, bloodshed, and loss. She rose from her bow and immediately launched into the details of the expedition, giving a terse, no-nonsense report. The spiders were encroaching again. There was sign of Imperial soldiers moving along the northern border of the marshes. The Moss Hag had struck again. Then offered an account of finding me and Cutter stranded in the death pit. The chieftain listened placidly, little emotion displayed on his face. Then dismissed her from the room before turning his gaze on me.
"Well," he finally said as the door shut, "what do you have to say for yourself, boy?"
I fidgeted nervously, clearing my throat as I tried to figure out what to say. Truthfully, Amara had summed everything up much more efficiently than I ever could have. I struggled for another few seconds, the silence turning into an uncomfortable weight around my shoulders. Then, the chief did something to break the tension. He smiled, a wide grin missing a few teeth.
"Relax, boy,"
he said with a bark and an eye roll.
"You and your friend are safe. You are no Viridian cutthroat come to collect my scalp. Even a blind man could see that. Some of my clan, like my daughter Amara, whom you've had the pleasure of meeting, can be a little zealous in their disdain for the Empire. At times a bit overzealous, perhaps. Such passion is both the blessing and curse of youth."
I gulped, feeling weak in the knees. That crazy mask-wearing woman was his daughter?
"I, on the other hand," he said after a pause, "have the benefit of many years on my side. Such time often brings a certain degree of wisdom and discernment. As a result, I am not quite so quick to rush to judgment. This gift of time also allows me to use my eyes."
He paused, grinned, and tapped at the corner of one eye.
"Not only do you not look like a cutthroat, you bear the blessing of the forest. Only the mighty tree kin can issue such trinkets, and the trees have far better discernment than even the oldest of our kind. If one of the elder tree brothers thinks highly enough of you to give you such a gift, I can at least hear you out. So please, come, sit, relax, and tell me your tale."
I let out a huge sigh of relief, and my legs seemed to move me forward as though on autopilot. Before I knew it, I was seated on the floor across from the chieftain, spilling my story. I told them everything, waking up in the cell, finding the old woman, giving her the potion, trying to resuscitate her, and failing. He listened thoughtfully as I talked, nodding or frowning in all the right places. I told him that I knew about the Black Priest of Serth Rog, which didn't amount to much. Still, he seemed to absorb the details with great meaning, as though finally fitting some long-lost missing puzzle piece into place.
"Well,"
he said as I finished, folding his hands in his lap,
"that certainly clears up a few things."
"Does that mean you know what that priest was doing then?" I asked, genuinely curious about the mystery. He canted his head to one side, brow furrowed, and nodded.
"There is still much I do not know," he said gravely, "but this is not the first such report to reach my ears. Folk from all six named clans have gone missing over the past several months, many never to reappear again. A few, however, have returned, but they are different from when they left. To the undiscerning eye, these doppelgangers may go unnoticed, but I have noticed. Their bodies are whole, but they are absent a soul, or at least their soul. These dark priests are hollowing people out and replacing them with corrupt spirits from Morsheim, the realm of Sirthrog. To what end this is being done, I cannot yet say.
A notification popped up as he thoughtfully trailed off. Quest update. Imposter Georgie. Chief Cole of the Akhani clan has informed you that the Black Priests of Sirthrog are replacing people with convincing doppelgangers, though he doesn't know why. Tell Cutter about the new revelation in order to get to the bottom of Gentleman Georgie's strange shift in personality. Quest class. Unique. Personal. Quest difficulty. Hard. Success. Help Cutter get to the bottom of the mystery surrounding Gentleman Georgie's sudden personality change. Failure? Refuse to help Cutter or allow him to die before the mission is complete. Reward? Question mark.
That aside, the chief continued, I truly cannot thank you enough for fulfilling the final wish of our dear departed sister, especially at such great risk to yourself. You do not know this, but one of our elders, Lariat Shadowrunner, went missing near a month ago, and we've been urgently searching for her. That talisman you bear belonged to her. Her passing is a terrible thing, a deep loss to our people, but better to know than to suffer in uncertainty.
He was silent for a long time, staring at me. Jaw clenched tight, forehead creased, eyes unfocused, as though he were seeing something far off.
That talisman she gave you, I think you should keep it. Lariat would have liked that. Besides, you may find use of it yet, since this is not the end of your journey among us, but rather the beginning. I am Matal myself, the chief Dark Templar of the Akhani, and I can see the shadow spark burning inside you. I can see the mark Elder Lariat left upon you. It is possible you are destined to become one of us, boy. If, that is, you have the mettle to endure what is to come. But,
he paused, rubbing a hand along his jaw.
It is late, and I can see you are tired. So, for tonight, I will have you and your friend put in guest quarters. In the morning, we'll discuss your induction into the esteemed ranks of the Dark Templars.
He frowned again, lips curling into a thin line.
But sleep first.
He shook his head and looked away.
I don't envy you, boy. Not at all.
A level up notification and a quest update appeared as the chief dismissed me.
Times one, level up. You have 25 undistributed stat points. Stat points can be allocated at any time. You have 10 unassigned proficiency points. Proficiency points can be allocated at any time. Quest update. Plight of the Matal. You have informed Chief Cole of the Akhani clan about the awful experiments of the Black Priests of Sirthrog, and successfully delivered the sacred talisman of the dying Merkelf, Lariat. In return, you have received 15,000 EXP. In order to fully complete this quest and receive the reward, unique, scalable item, and the Shadowmancer class kit, you must complete the Matal initiation ordeal. Quest class, rare, class-based. Quest difficulty, hard. Success,
surviving the Martal initiation ordeal. Failure: die during the Martal initiation ordeal. Reward: class change, Dark Templar, Shadowmancer kit, unique, scalable item.
I gave them a cursory scan without much enthusiasm. I should have been stoked beyond belief. After all, I'd survived finding Chief Cole, picked up another level, and was on the verge of unlocking my game class. So, yeah, I should have been stoked. But instead, I just felt exhausted beyond belief. And sick. Really sick. My head throbbed. My muscles were suddenly as limp as wet noodles, and freezing chills and flaming nausea racked my body in turns. I found the ever-friendly Amara, who was wearing her mask once more, waiting to escort me outside the building. She guided me through the town, carrying me more often than not as my legs stopped working. I was vaguely aware of Lurch stumbling up a set of wooden steps and into one of the raised buildings before slamming to the floor as every muscle in my body tightened in the same instant. In the back of my mind, I recalled that I was dangerously close to the 72-hour in-game mark. But the thought didn't stay long as I passed out in sheer agony. Rebirth. I spent the rest of the night and the majority of the next day slipping between consciousness and unconsciousness. When I slept, I had terrible fever dreams of the real world. I saw my parents, my father balding and pot-bellied, my mother wearing a floral print dress, die. I saw the skin slough off their bones as murderous space fire ate them up. I watched my co-workers, Jeff and Angelina, perish as a wave 200 feet tall swept in from the ocean, smashing into buildings, flipping cars, drowning people in their homes. I witnessed my ex-girlfriend, now living in Colorado, scream as the ground swelled and buckled, ripping open, then swallowing her into the heart of the earth. Horrific nightmares, all of them. But waking was even worse. Far worse. My thoughts were oddly heavy and slipped away whenever I tried to focus on one thing for more than a few seconds. Everything seemed to blur on the edges, bleeding together while the walls spun and twisted into amorphous blobs of technicolor vomit. And awake, there was pain. My insides felt like they'd been dunked in a vat of acid, a terrible molten liquid searing every nerve ending. My heart jackrabbited away inside my chest. Every breath was forced and agonizing, like inhaling fine specks of jagged glass. My body randomly convulsed, the muscle contractions so intense they snapped bones. I'd never experienced anything like it, and part of me wanted nothing more than to die. After 15 hours, which felt much more like 15 years, the pain dimmed to a dull, full-body throb, and I finally came to my senses. I was lying on a narrow pallet in the corner of a tiny room, which boasted a single chair and a rough-hewn table with a pitcher of water and a basin. Cutter lounged in the chair, hands folded in his lap, eyes closed while he snored softly. Passed out. There were several windows, all shuttered, but late afternoon sunlight streamed in around the edges, illuminating a swirl of dust motes floating in the air. Cautiously, I sat up and stretched out sore muscles, twisting this way and that, checking for any kind of long-term damage from my illness. Sophia, my ever-present companion, piped up mid-stretch, alerting me that I had a message from Osmark customer support. I played it immediately. "Traveler,"
intoned an overly chipper and annoyingly familiar voice.
This is Matthew, your customer support representative. Our system records indicate you've spent your third full night in Viridian Gate Online. Congratulations! Our system indicates that your physical body lapsed into cardiac arrest roughly 2 hours ago. Your time of death was approximately 6:17 a.m. Pacific Standard Time. You have our deepest condolences. But we are happy to inform you that you've successfully transitioned to VGO. Likely, you've experienced some very unpleasant sensations over the past several hours. But those feelings will pass and you should fully recover. Make sure you stop by your nearest inn or tavern and eat a hearty meal. As a side note, an Osmark Tech retrieval team has already been dispatched to your physical location. Your body and effects will remain at your residence, but your capsule will be removed, cleaned, and recirculated for the good of humanity. Thank you for playing. And just like that, Matthew's voice was gone. Gone like my body. I was dead. Back in my apartment, my physical heart was unmoving and cold. My eyes glassy, my skin sallow, my guts bloated. I was dead. Carefully, I reached up and ran a hand along my cheek, feeling the bristly bite of facial hair. I dragged my fingers along my jawline, then slipped them onto my neck, gently pressing two digits into my carotid artery, searching for my pulse. It was there, strong and steady below my fingertips. I was dead. Yet, here I was, sitting on a pallet, feeling my heart thump away in my chest, circulating blood through my body. Wow. Surreal. I'd known from the get-go that Viridian Gate was my final destination. I'd known it, but I hadn't really believed it. There's a world of difference between knowing something intellectually and accepting it into your heart as true. I'd known, but I hadn't believed. Not until now. A small part of me grieved over the loss, because it was a loss, and not just the loss of my physical body. It was the loss of everything I'd ever had. It was the death of my job, the death of my friends, the death of my family, the death of my apartment, city, nation, and world. It was all-consuming and deeply personal. But then I paused and once more felt the drumming rhythm of my heartbeat beneath my fingers. I threw back my head and laughed. Holy shit! I was alive! Somehow, miraculously, I'd lived. And not just through my own death. I'd survived the end of the world. For weeks, I'd been moping around IRL consumed by the looming threat of the asteroid. But I'd beaten that ball of flame, too. It couldn't kill me if my body was already a bloated bag of cold meat. I'd been reborn. I chuckled again, a raucous hoot so loud it startled Cutter awake. He jumped in surprise, then promptly fell from the chair, which only made me laugh harder.
Yeah, laugh it up, asshole,
Cutter muttered disgruntledly, pushing himself upright and brushing off dusty palms on his britches.
It's not like I watched over you all night, force-feeding you and dribbling water into your mouth so you wouldn't die. My pain is amusement to you. I understand how it is.
It's not that, I said, gaining my feet with a wide, goofy grin. I survived, Cutter. I made it. The sickness you told me about, the one that kills travelers, I survived. I transitioned.
I threw an arm into the air, an epic fist pump.
I'm alive, motherfuckers!
I shouted, before breaking out into a renewed fit of giggles.
Joy for you,
Cutter replied with an eye roll.
Would you like a medal for your achievement, eh? I'm alive too, maybe I should celebrate. Though, come to think of it, I'm not entirely sure waking up in the morning really qualifies as a major victory. Not unless you're a phenomenal loser.
He glanced at me and sniffed.
I'll revise my statement. Maybe you do deserve a medal.
Jerk, I replied half-heartedly. Considering I just survived the end of the world, it was hard to be offended. And thanks for your help, Cutter. You're a mostly good friend. He snorted and rolled his eyes.
One near-death experience, and now you're all misty-eyed. Look, if you really want to thank me,
he said,
how's about you pull yourself together and get over to the chieftain before that awful Amara loses her patience and feeds us both to bog gators? She told me if you died, I was next on the chopping block. Practically had to fight her off with a stick to keep her out of here.
That sobered me up pretty quickly. In my jubilation, I'd sort of forgotten about the Matal initiation ordeal waiting for me like a bar drunk loitering in an alleyway looking for a brawl. And it also reminded me of the threat still hanging over VGO like a dark cloud. There was a group of corrupt uber-elites looking to rule this world with an iron fist. My joy at surviving morphed and hardened into something new. A fierce resolve to protect Eldgard. Maybe VGO had been a game once, but it wasn't anymore. Not to me. It was my world now, and it had given me a second chance to live. It had offered Abby and millions of other people a second chance to live, and I'd be damned if I'd let anyone take that away. Not if I could do anything about it. You're right, I said with a nod. Time to go get my hands dirty. Wish me luck. I turned and headed for the door.
Luck,
Cutter called out behind me. Amara was waiting outside, awake and alert as ever, though she'd finally taken off her mask. She offered me a perfunctory greeting, but didn't have two more words to spare for me as she escorted me back to the chieftain's tree. Since she didn't seem interested in gabbing, I pulled out a slab of mutton and ate while we walked. I was just finishing up with my on-the-go breakfast when we arrived at the squat tree in the heart of Yunnam. Amara pushed and shoved me up the stairs, apparently dissatisfied that the chief had decided not to kill me. She knocked. A terse, "Enter!" immediately followed. The chief was leaning against the far wall, back turned, peering out of a rounded window, casually drumming his fingers on the wooden frame. I stood in the entryway for a few minutes, shuffling nervously from foot to foot. Eventually, I cleared my throat, once, twice, three times, which finally got his attention.
Grimjack, he said with a little shiver.